With apologies to Stanley Kubrick, the episode in which we learned to stop worrying and love the bond market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, August the 9th, 2017. Remember that date, by the way. You're going to need it later. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So look, I get it. I get that headlines about fire and fury and escalation and threats and all that has happened in the past 24 hours is alarming. Allow me, if I might, though, without discounting the reality of what's going on out there, to cut through maybe some of the fear. There is nothing in this economy that reacts as viscerally to the news, whether good or bad, as do the markets. The bond market in particular, a refuge in times of uncertainty like this. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, the bond markets are telling us to take a deep breath.
The ancient Greeks had the oracle at Delphi. That kid had that dog, Lassie. We have the bond market. And here's what the bond market has to say about North Korea.
We've been through these types of situations with North Korea before. The markets don't believe that war is imminent.
David Krause teaches finance at Marquette University. If bond buyers were freaked out about North Korea, they would move their money to long-term bonds, pushing the price up and yields down.
There's been very little movement.
There's been a little, and I mean a teensy bit, of long-term bond buying, but not a lot. One place where the bond market appears to be raising an eyebrow, at least, is around the debt ceiling deadline in October.
If the ceiling isn't raised, then potentially, it's a small probability, default could occur.
Sinead Colton is head of investment strategy with Mellon Capital. Bonds coming due when we expect the debt ceiling debate to be raging have gotten slightly less popular. Emphasis, though, on slightly.
Well, a smidge is a smidge. It's not significant.
Marilyn Cohen is CEO of Envision Capital. Compared with the last debt ceiling crisis, bonds are barely moving.
I do not think that this administration is going to play a game of chicken with that debt ceiling.
So at the end of the day, the bond market does not really care. It does not care about North Korea. It does not care a lot about the debt ceiling. With one important caveat, it does not care for now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
For now. The straight-up business story of this Wednesday, inspired by Disney's announcement it's going to launch its own streaming service and bail on Netflix in a couple of years, is good old-fashioned cable TV and how it's hanging on in this streaming economy. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
It used to be cable operators just offered pay TV packages. But today's telecoms and cable companies, like AT&T and Comcast, own a vast network of broadband pipes, which provide high-speed internet access into homes. Eric Brannon is principal analyst at IHS Market Technology. He says whether customers are paying for cable or paying for internet packages to stream Netflix doesn't matter to the cable operators.
They're still in the home. They've still got a customer relationship with that household.
Brannon calculates that in 2011, there were about 47 million cable broadband households. He forecasts that number will climb to nearly 72 million by 2021. For pay TV households, the numbers are headed in the other direction. Brannon says, sure, right now cable operators charge less for monthly broadband than for cable TV.
However, growth in broadband revenue and growth in broadband subscribers does correlate to increased total profits for these companies.
So it's not necessarily a bad thing for cable companies if customers use their broadband to stream Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, and, in a couple years, Disney. Doing so requires premium internet service. Here's technology consultant Jeff Kagan.
The growing part of the cable television industry isn't cable television. It's internet. The internet is the core that everything rides over, whether the internet is wireline or whether it's wireless.
As for Disney's prospects as a streaming service, that's an open question. Kagan says it's unclear how many streaming services people will want to sign up for. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Wall Street today shrugging once more in the face of geopolitical agita. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In South Africa, there is political disquiet this week to go along with economic discontent. The parliament there tried and failed, as perhaps you read, to get rid of President Jacob Zuma yesterday. A vote of no confidence did not get the votes needed to pass, but it was closer than it's ever been, and it showed Zuma's own party, the African National Congress, is deeply divided amongst itself. Zuma has been accused of corruption on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars. Unemployment in South Africa is at 27%, above that a little bit, actually. Its sovereign debt is officially junk. Sean Gossel is a senior finance lecturer at the University of Cape Town's Graduate School of Business. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
What, in a nutshell, is what got us to this point?
Back in, since 2009, really, South Africa never really recovered from the financial crisis and never really got its economy up and running on all cylinders again. So as a consequence, there's been misspending predominantly through our state-owned enterprises. And that's what's brought us to this point where the state-owned enterprises have not offered efficiently priced services and have been used for nefarious reasons, predominantly in the form of looting. And as a result, the creditworthiness has been declining to the extent now that we've actually been downgraded.
About that debt downgrade, the debt servicing agency, the debt rating agencies, rather, specifically mentioned government dysfunction and internal party squabbles when it made that debt downgrade back in April, right?
Correct, yes. And that's related to the Zuma-Gupta state capture problems that have come to light in recent months. The Guptas are basically an Indian family of Indian descent. They came to South Africa in 1993 and are very closely interlinked with ANC politicians and have basically been laundering money that was destined for the state-owned enterprises into their own shadow companies.
Here we are with unemployment at 14-year highs in South Africa. The debt has been downgraded to junk. The ruling party is deeply internally split. Elections, though, are not until 2019. What happens between now and then?
We've got an upcoming impeachment process, not so much in the extent that they anticipate Zuma being impeached, but because it's through the courts, it means Zuma does have to testify, which then opens him up to perjury charges if he lies about what's been going on with the Gupta family. There's also going to be ongoing votes of no confidence. We've recently had the first one was yesterday, but the opposition parties have indicated that they are going to be doing it more regularly so that hopefully more ANC MPs will get used to the idea that they can actually vote in secret without any recourse and therefore will vote more honestly and down the line possibly get rid of Jacob Zuma as president, which is highly unlikely in my own personal opinion.
None of that is going to make the economy tangibly better, right? It's not going to lower unemployment. It's not going to improve the bond rating But I imagine what the hope is that confidence will return and thus things will slowly begin turning around.
Yes, confidence will only return, though, if there's a clear indication that the Zuma-Gupta alliance and the effects thereof are weakening. And at the moment, there's no indication that that is the case. We haven't seen any prosecutions. So most of the action that we're seeing is from opposition parties, and we're seeing also private companies and private creditors now putting pressure on government to essentially self-correct. But South Africa's economy is in dire straits, and nothing's going to change that direction in the short term.
Sean Gossel, he's a senior lecturer in finance at the University of Cape Town, their Graduate School of Business there. Sean, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
While the back and forth over what, if anything, the GOP is going to be able to get done on health care continues. Just this week, by the way, President Trump and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have been sniping at each other about who's to blame for what. But while all that continues, the real problems in the American healthcare economy continue. And here's one. A federal program that lets hospitals buy some drugs at deep discounts and, in theory, use those savings elsewhere. In theory. From the health desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has the story.
Back in the 1990s, some hospitals were buckling under the weight of low-income and uninsured patients. Enter the so-called 340B program, which offered these hospitals a sweet deal. Hospitals could buy certain drugs, like for cancer, at 20 to 50% off, turn around, charge privately insured or Medicare patients the full rate, and pocket the savings. Here's Vanderbilt economist Saye Nikpe.
The assumption is that these hospitals will use the difference to funnel money back into safety net operations, things like running a discounted drug program.
That's the kind of thing happening here on the west side of Chicago at Mount Sinai Hospital.
Code blue, CCU room 830, bed 1.
Mount Sinai primarily serves uninsured and low-income people. The hospital says the $5 million it got last year from the 340B program went to things like getting patients important medication for free. For example, a 29-year-old woman who was treated for a rare infection that stretched from her throat to her chest. Her physician, Dr. Ihab Aziz, says she walked out with the meds she needed.
Without appropriate antibiotics, the infection would spread, and she will have something called septicemia, which is organ failure from severe infection, and she will die.
This, arguably, is how the program is supposed to run, and how many hospitals say they're able to provide essential services to their neediest patients. But the economics of 340B may be too enticing.
We believe that entirely too many hospitals are gaming the system.
That's Stephanie Silverman, the spokesperson for a coalition of organizations, including drug companies, who are obliged to offer the discounts. Silverman argues there's a design flaw in 340B. It incentivizes hospitals to prescribe the most expensive drugs they can get to as many full-pay patients as possible.
We see hospitals doing all sorts of things to try and maximize how many 340B dollars they get.
A report from the Congressional Watchdog, the Government Accountability Office, suggests 340B hospitals buy fewer generics than other hospitals. And research from the University of Chicago shows hospitals have gone on buying sprees, scooping up oncology practices and outpatient clinics, often in wealthy communities. Critics say one reason they're doing that is to get access to even more of those full-pay patients. Vanderbilt's Saye Nikpay says it's unclear what hospitals are doing with that pile of cash.
There's very little oversight of the program, so no one has really been checking to see if the savings are actually being used to subsidize care to those uninsured and underinsured patients.
There's certainly nothing in the program that requires or even incentivizes hospitals to pipe revenue back to low-income patient services. The agency overseeing 340B, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, says seniors are paying nearly $200 million a year more for drugs than they need to. CMS's Demetrius Kazoukas.
Seniors shouldn't be paying these inflated drug prices in a way that comes right out of their pockets.
CMS's proposal is to let hospitals keep the discounts while cutting Medicare's reimbursement rate. That could mean cheaper copays for seniors and relief for drug makers if the change forces hospitals to drop out of 340B. But it could simultaneously hurt the hospitals that depend on this money and their patients who have few options. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
women have learned to love themselves and to understand that every healthy body is not a straight size.
Profits come in all sizes, but first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the sad music, but not by much. The Dow Industrial's down 36 points, about a 10%, 22,048. NASDAQ down 18 points, 0.2%, 6,352. The S&P 500 essentially flat, 24.74 there. Talked about Disney's plans to end its deal with Netflix and launch its own streaming service. Disney shares off 3.8%. Netflix down 1.4% today. Comcast rose 1.7%. There's trouble in the travel market. Priceline down 7% today after its upcoming bookings showed some softness. TripAdvisor up 2.5% today. Expedia gained 1.3%. European markets were down. The FTSE down about 0.5%. Germany's DAX declined 1.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a report out yesterday from the Department of Energy that was kind of interesting. For the first time in almost 60 years, the United States is set to become a net exporter of natural gas. We've got, or can now get to, in ways that didn't used to exist, lots of it. Not up to speed, though, is our energy infrastructure. There's a ton of natural gas underground in western Colorado. Being landlocked as Colorado is, though, access to overseas markets can be tricky. There was a natural gas terminal planned for coastal Oregon, not all that far from Colorado when you think about it. The Obama administration put the kibosh on the thing, but the White House, right now, Trump, is talking about bringing it back. From the public media newsroom Inside Energy, Dan Boyce has the story.
66 trillion cubic feet. That's how much natural gas the USGS now estimates is locked in the Mancos Shale Formation in western Colorado. The industry thinks there's even more. David Ludlam with the West Slope Colorado Oil and Gas Association.
Even if you're in the industry, it's hard to wrap your mind around. I mean, we haven't begun to grapple as a nation with what we truly have.
There's enough natural gas in the Mancos Shale to power the whole country for more than 2 years. Except the drillers here have to compete with drillers everywhere else. And right now, the Mancos has a profit problem.
It's just more profitable in other areas and other states that have a direct connection to bigger markets.
He means overseas markets. The more markets you can access, the higher the prices you can charge. The country's other major natural gas fields all have direct access to terminals where the gas can be converted to a liquid and shipped abroad. The catch? Not one of these other so-called liquefied natural gas or LNG terminals is located on the West Coast. Not yet.
The first thing we're going to do is we're going to permit an LNG export facility in the Northwest.
That's President Trump's chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, speaking at an international finance summit in April. He's talking about the proposed Jordan Cove terminal in Coos Bay, Oregon. Asian countries need a lot of natural gas, more than they can supply themselves.
Just think of the transport time from the Northwest to Japan versus anywhere else.
Way cheaper to haul gas from the Oregon coast than, say, the Gulf of Mexico. The Jordan Cove terminal would help the U.S. compete with other gas exporters like Australia and Qatar for that Asian market. But a lot of people living near the site of the proposed project, they're not convinced.
Very discouraging to have to fight this thing over and over again.
Clarence Adams is a landowner in Douglas County, Oregon. See, permitting the facility falls to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. They denied Jordan Cove's permit last year twice.
Once they lose, they should lose, period.
He opposes the project because a pipeline serving the terminal would have to be built right across his property. And that's a reason FERC denied the permit, saying it didn't justify using what's called eminent domain to force pipeline construction through private land. Lena Moffitt is with the Sierra Club, and she's against the project from a climate perspective. She says Asian countries are doubling down on renewable energy, and approving more fossil fuel projects is a step backward.
These kinds of long-term investments, new infrastructure that locks us into expanded gas reliance, are not needed.
Still, it's those very same investments and the jobs they'd bring that industry is using to argue for FERC reversing its decision. David Ludlam with the West Slope Colorado Oil and Gas Association says the long-term, stable contracts signed with foreign buyers are highly desirable.
We're looking for a different type of investor, one that can come in and own reserves in the ground alongside our producers and provide a economic certainty.
And the industry is getting optimistic that the conversation about the terminal is not over. Elizabeth Spomer is president and CEO of Jordan Cove LNG.
We've got a new administration who's very, very much pro-LNG exports.
Just before heading out for its August recess, the U.S. Senate voted to confirm two Trump nominees to open FERC seats. Both are considered friendly to oil and gas interests. The Canadian company proposing the terminal, Veresen, says it intends to refile the formal Jordan Cove permit application by the end of the month. I'm Dan Boyce for Marketplace.
Retail, as we've been reporting for a while now, is in some trouble, but there are parts of it that are doing all right, good even. The market research firm NPD Group says plus-size fashion was up 6% last year, twice the rate of apparel overall, and that's despite the general lack of big brand names in that space. Ashley C. Ford writes for Refinery 29. She's got a new piece out on the business of plus-size fashion. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Where did women of larger sizes shop for fashion before?
Mostly Lane Bryant. And beforehand, there were just a lot of tricks and tips, and there was a lot of making your own clothes, and there was a lot of here's how to buy things in straight sizes that are oversized and make them fit your body, or, you know, things like that. Like, it was a lot of internet sharing and community sharing of how to adorn our bodies in a way that truly allowed us to feel as beautiful as we are.
You mentioned internet sharing. You went into a brick and mortar retailer, and I can't remember which one it was. You didn't see your sizes there, and you went to the salesperson and you said, "Where can I find stuff?" And they said, "Online." And you went online, and it was a cornucopia, really, of stuff for you to wear.
Yes, absolutely.
That's so interesting.
That is something that you see with a lot of brick and mortar stores for some reason that I can't entirely explain. And these places don't really market the fact that they actually do carry sizes larger than a 10 or a 12 or a 14. Mm-hmm. And so people just don't know to go there. They have no idea unless they happen upon it. You know, it's still most likely to happen online versus in the store.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned marketing. And in this piece that you wrote, there's some old Lane Bryan ads, which are unbelievable. Stout women dress fashionably, look slender. And then calling all chubbies, another woman, a full-size woman in a dress. And then you scroll down, and there's a Lane Bryan ad just owning it. Modern day, out there saying, listen, in fact, here's the tagline. This body is made to be uncovered. It's remarkable, the change.
It absolutely is. And that change has really been driven by the community. As women have learned to love themselves and to understand that every healthy body is not a straight size, we've pushed this market. And I love seeing that ad from Lane Bryan. I love that it ended up being part of the piece because it is a great representation of how far we've come. And there's so much further to go.
Here comes the nuts and bolts question. Retail has been struggling, as I'm sure you know.
Absolutely.
Does this emphasis on plus-size fashions and the profit it can bring, does it last, do you think?
I think it does last. And I think it lasts because the market is clearly starving for it. And on top of that, the market right now is really being driven by teen voices. You know, I'm not, you know, that much, like I'm 30, you know, so it's like, you know, I could be saying this and then, you know, 30 years, it could be like, who cares? That generation is gone, you know, whatever. But the truth of the matter is people who are much, much younger than me are begging for these options, are less begging than demanding these options. I think offering options is never a bad thing, especially to a community who is ready and willing to give you their money.
Ashley C. Ford, she's at Refinery 29 writing for New York Magazine on plus-size fashions. Ashley, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, there used to be a feature on the BNP Paribas website, the big French bank, that would let you download recordings of their press releases. It's gone now, sadly, that feature. But 10 years ago today, August the 9th, 2007, this is what the American economy woke up to.
The complete evaporation of liquidity in certain market segments of the U.S. securitization market has made it impossible to value certain assets fairly regardless of their quality or credit rating.
Complete evaporation of liquidity in securities markets, impossible to value assets. Ominous phrases and a marker, really, that the credit crisis and the Great Recession were a-coming. Overnight, BNP Paribas had shut down three of its hedge funds that had bought heavily into subprime mortgages, or as Stephen Beard put it that day when I asked him about it.
Well, this is, I think, the most fascinating aspect of this. It seems that what has happened is that American banks have very cleverly been shoveling large amounts of this low-grade material over onto this side of the Atlantic. What appears to have happened is this. In the low interest rate world that we've lived in over the past few years, banks and other financial institutions have been increasingly desperate to get higher yields, to get a bigger return for their money. That has attracted them to these, what turn out to be now very risky, American subprime mortgages.
You tell people they can't get their money back, as BNP Paribas did that day, and as we now know in hindsight, bad things happen. What is striking, though, listening back to tape of that day, is how little we really appreciated how bad it was going to get. As it happens, President Bush had a press conference 10 years ago today. He was asked about the BNP Paribas news and the health of the American housing market.
I talked about the different scenarios that I had been briefed on about whether or not there'd be precipitous decline in housing or whether it'd be what one would call a soft landing. And it appeared at this point in time that it looks we're headed for a soft landing. And that's what the facts say.
In his defense, pretty much everybody missed it, right? That was 10 years ago. Today, history is an interesting thing. All right, we got to go. Wall Street once again gave a giant shrug to the geopolitical news of the day. The Dow off 36 points, about a 10%. NASDAQ down 18, 0.2%. S&P 500 basically flat. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.